3 days, and by 1 day of wood-carrying, in like manner, 3 times as much. In all, 42 corvée days. To this had to be added the so-called jobagie, service due to the lord for extraordinary occasions. In proportion to the size of its population, every village has to furnish annually a definite contingent to the jobagie. This additional corvée is estimated at 14 days for each Wallachian peasant. Thus, the prescribed corvée amounts to 56 working days yearly. But the agricultural year in Wallachia numbers, in consequence of the severe climate, only 210 days, of which 40 for Sundays and holidays, 30 on an average for bad weather, together 70 days, do not count. 140 working days remain. The ratio of the corvée to the necessary labour, 56/84, or 66 2/3%, gives a much smaller rate of surplus value than that which regulates the labour of the English agricultural or factory labourer. This is, however, only the legally prescribed corvée. And in a spirit yet more liberal than the English Factory Acts, the Règlement Organique has known how to facilitate its own evasion. After it has made 56 days out of 12, the nominal day's work of each of the 56 corvée days is again so arranged that a portion of it must fall on the ensuing day. In 1 day, for example, must be weeded an extent of land which, for this work, especially in maize plantations, needs twice as much time. The legal day's work for some kinds of agricultural labour is interpretable in such a way that the day begins in May and ends in October. In Moldavia, conditions are still harder. "The 12 corvée days of the Règlement Organique," cried a boyard drunk with victory, "amount to 365 days in the year." Footnote. Further details are to be found in E. Reignolt's Histoire politique et sociale des Principautés Danubiennes, Paris, 1855. End of footnote. If the Règlement Organique of the Danubian provinces was a positive expression of the greed for surplus labour which every paragraph legalised, the English Factory Acts are the negative expression of the same greed. These acts curb the passion of capital for a limitless draining of labour power by forcibly limiting the working day by state regulations, made by a state that is ruled by capitalist and landlord. Apart from the working-class movement that daily grew more threatening, the limiting of factory labour was dictated by the same necessity which spread guano over the English fields, the same blind eagerness for plunder that in the one case exhausted the soil, had, in the other, torn up by the roots the living force of the nation. Periodical epidemics speak on this point as clearly as the diminishing military standard in Germany and France. Footnote. In general, and within certain limits, exceeding the medium size of their kind is evidence of the prosperity of organic beings. As to man, his bodily height lessens if his due growth is interfered with, either by physical or local conditions. In all European countries in which the conscription holds, since its introduction, the medium height of adult men and generally their fitness for military service has diminished. Before the Revolution, 1789, the minimum for the infantry in France was 165 centimetres. In 1818, law of March the 10th, 157. By the law of March the 21st, 1832, 156 centimetres. On the average in France, more than half are rejected on account of deficient height or bodily weakness. The minimum standard in Saxony was, in 1780, 178 centimetres. It is now 155. In Prussia, it is 157. According to the statement of Dr. Meyer in the Bavarian Gazette, May the 9th, 1862, the result of an average of 9 years is that in Prussia, out of 1,000 conscripts, 716 were unfit for military service, 317 because of deficiency in height, and 399 because of bodily defects. Berlin, in 1858, could not provide its contingent of recruits. It was 156 men short. J. von Liebig, Die Chemie in ihrer Anwendung auf Agrikultur und Physiologie, 1862. End of footnote. The Factory Act of 1850, now in force, 1867, allows for the average working day 10 hours, that is, for the first 5 days, 12 hours, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., including half an hour for breakfast and an hour for dinner, and thus leaving 10.5 working hours, and 8 hours for Saturday, from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m., of which half an hour is subtracted for breakfast. 60 working hours are left. 10.5 for each of the first 5 days, 7.5 for the last. Footnote. The history of the Factory Act of 1850 will be found in the course of this chapter. Certain guardians of these laws are appointed factory inspectors, directly under the Home Secretary, whose reports are published half-yearly by order of Parliament. They give regular and official statistics of the capitalistic greed for surplus labour. Footnote. I only touch here and there on the period from the beginning of modern industry in England to 1845. For this period I refer the reader to Condition of the Working Class in England, von Friedrich Engels, Leipzig, 1845. How completely Engels understood the nature of the capitalist mode of production is shown by the factory reports, reports on mines, etc., that have appeared since 1845. And how wonderfully he painted the circumstances in detail is seen on the most superficial comparison of his work with the official reports of the Children's Employment Commission, published 18 to 20 years later, 1863 to 1867. These deal especially with the branches of industry in which the Factory Acts had not, up to 1862, been introduced. In fact, are not yet introduced. Here, then, little or no alteration had been enforced by authority in the conditions painted by Engels. I borrow my examples chiefly from the free trade period after 1848, that age of paradise, of which the commercial travellers for the great firm of free trade, blatant as ignorant, tell such fabulous tales. For the rest, England figures here in the foreground because she is the classic representative of capitalist production, and she alone has a continuous set of official statistics of the things we are considering. End of footnote. Let us listen, for a moment, to the factory inspectors. The fraudulent mill owner begins work a quarter of an hour, sometimes more, sometimes less, before 6 a.m., and leaves off a quarter of an hour, sometimes more, sometimes less, after 6 p.m. He takes 5 minutes from the beginning and from the end of the half-hour nominally allowed for breakfast, and 10 minutes at the beginning and end of the hour nominally allowed for dinner. He works for a quarter of an hour, sometimes more, sometimes less, after 2 p.m. on Saturday. Thus his gain is: before 6 a.m., 15 minutes, after 6 p.m., 15 minutes, at breakfast time, 10 minutes, at dinner time, 20 minutes, total daily, 60 minutes. 5 days, 300 minutes. On Saturday, before 6 a.m., 15 minutes, at breakfast time, 10 minutes, after 2 p.m., 15 minutes, total, 40 minutes. Total weekly, 340 minutes, or 5 hours and 40 minutes weekly, which, multiplied by 50 working weeks in the year, allowing 2 for holidays and occasional stoppages, is equal to 27 working days. Footnote. Suggestions, etc., by Mr. L. Horner, Inspector of Factories, in Factories Regulation Acts. Ordered by the House of Commons to be printed, 1859. 5 minutes a day's increased work, multiplied by weeks, are equal to 2.5 days of produce in the year. Footnote. Reports of the Inspector of Factories for the half-year, October 1856. An additional hour a day gained by small instalments before 6 a.m., after 6 p.m., and at the beginning and end of the times nominally fixed for meals, is nearly equivalent to working 13 months in the year. Crises, during which production is interrupted and the factories work short time, that is, for only part of the week, naturally do not affect the tendency to extend the working day. The less business there is, the more profit has to be made on the business done. The less time spent in work, the more of that time has to be turned into surplus labour time. Thus, the factory inspector's report on the period of the crisis from 1857 to 1858, it may seem inconsistent that there should be any overworking at a time when trade is so bad, but that very badness leads to the transgression by unscrupulous men. They get the extra profit of it. In the last half year, says Leonard Horner, 122 mills in my district have been given up. 143 were found standing. Yet, overwork is continued beyond the legal hours. For a great part of the time, says Mr. Howell, owing to the depression of trade, many factories were altogether closed, and a still greater number were working short time. I continue, however, to receive about the usual number of complaints that half or three-quarters of an hour in the day are snatched from the workers by encroaching upon the times professedly allowed for rest and refreshment. The same phenomenon was reproduced on a smaller scale during the frightful cotton crisis from 1861 to 1865. Footnote. The violations of the Acts became more numerous during the last half-year, 1863. It is sometimes advanced by way of excuse, when persons are found at work in a factory, either at a meal hour or at some illegal time, that they will not leave the mill at the appointed hour, and that compulsion is necessary to force them to cease work, cleaning their machinery, etc., especially on Saturday afternoons. But if the hands remain in a factory after the machinery has ceased to revolve, they would not have been so employed if sufficient time had been set apart specially for cleaning, etc., either before 6 a.m., sick, or before 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoons. Footnote. With what fanaticism, according to the evidence of manufacturers given in courts of law, their hands set themselves against every interruption in factory labour, the following curious circumstance shows. In the beginning of June, 1836, information reached the magistrates of Dewsbury, Yorkshire, that the owners of 8 large mills in the neighbourhood of Batley had violated the Factory Acts. Some of these gentlemen were accused of having kept at work 5 boys between 12 and 15 years of age from 6 a.m. on Friday to 4 p.m. on the following Saturday, not allowing them any respite except for meals and 1 hour for sleep at midnight. And these children had to do this ceaseless labour of 30 hours in the shoddy hole, as the hole is called, in which the woollen rags are pulled in pieces, and where a dense atmosphere of dust, shreds, etc., forces even the adult workman to cover his mouth continually with handkerchiefs for the protection of his lungs. The accused gentlemen affirm, in lieu of taking an oath, as Quakers they were too scrupulously religious to take an oath, that they had, in their great compassion for the unhappy children, allowed them 4 hours for sleep. But the obstinate children absolutely would not go to bed. The Quaker gentlemen were mulcted in £20. Dryden anticipated these gentry. Fox full fraught in seeming sanctity, that feared an oath, but like the devil would lie, that looked like Lent, and had the holy leer, and durst not sin, before he said his prayer. End of footnote. The profit to be gained by it, overworking in violation of the Act, appears to be, to many, a greater temptation than they can resist. They calculate upon the chance of not being found out, and when they see the small amount of penalty and costs, which those who have been convicted have had to pay, they find that if they should be detected there will still be a considerable balance of gain. In cases where the additional time is gained by a multiplication of small thefts in the course of the day, there are insuperable difficulties to the inspectors making out a case. These small thefts of capital from the labourer's meal and recreation time, the factory inspectors also designate as petty pilferings of minutes, snatching a few minutes, or, as the labourers technically called them, nibbling and cribbling at meal times. It is evident that in this atmosphere the formation of surplus value by surplus labour is no secret. "If you allow me," said a highly respectable master to me, "to work only 10 minutes in the day overtime, you put £1,000 a year in my pocket." Moments are the elements of profit. Nothing is, from this point of view, more characteristic than the designation of the workers who work full-time as full-timers, and the children under 13 who are only allowed to work 6 hours as half-timers. The worker is here nothing more than personified labour time. All individual distinctions are merged in those of full-timers and half-timers. Footnote. This is the official expression both in the factories and in the reports. End of footnote. Section 3. Branches of English industry without legal limits to exploitation. We have hitherto considered the tendency to the extension of the working day, the werewolf's hunger for surplus labour, in a department where the monstrous exactions, not surpassed, says an English bourgeois economist, by the cruelties of the Spaniards to the American redskins, caused capital at last to be bound by the chains of legal regulations. Footnote. The cupidity of millowners whose cruelty in the pursuit of gain have hardly been exceeded by those perpetrated by the Spaniards on the conquest of America in the pursuit of gold. John Wade, History of the Middle and Working Classes, 3rd edition, London, 1835. The theoretical part of this book, a kind of handbook of political economy, is, considering the time of its publication, original in some parts, for example on commercial crises. The historical part is, to a great extent, a shameless plagiarism of Sir F. M. Eden's The State of the Poor, London, 1797. End of footnote. Now, let us cast a glance at certain branches of production in which the exploitation of labour is either free from fetters to this day, or was so yesterday. Mr. Broughton Charlton, County Magistrate, declared as chairman of a meeting held at the Assembly Rooms, Nottingham, on the 14th of January, 1860, that there was an amount of privation and suffering among that portion of the population connected with the lace trade, unknown in other parts of the kingdom, indeed in the civilized world. Children of 9 or 10 years are dragged from their squalid beds at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning, and compelled to work for a bare subsistence until 10, 11, or 12 at night, their limbs wearing away, their frames dwindling, their faces whitening, and their humanity absolutely sinking into a stone-like torpor, utterly horrible to contemplate. We are not surprised that Mr. Mallett, or any other manufacturer, should stand forward and protest against discussion. The system, as the Reverend Montague Valpy describes it, is one of unmitigated slavery, socially, physically, morally, and spiritually. What can be thought of a town which holds a public meeting to petition that the period of labour for men shall be diminished to 18 hours a day? We declaim against the Virginian and Carolinian cotton planters. Is their black market, their lash, and their barter of human flesh more detestable than this slow sacrifice of humanity, which takes place in order that veils and collars may be fabricated for the benefit of capitalists? Footnote. Daily Telegraph, 17th of January, 1860. End of footnote. The potteries of Staffordshire have, during the last 22 years, been the subject of 3 parliamentary inquiries. The result is embodied in Mr. Scriven's report of 1841 to the Children's Employment Commissioners, in the report of Dr. Greenhow of 1860, published by order of the Medical Officer of the Privy Council, Public Health, Third Report, lastly, in the report of Mr. Long of 1862, in the first report of the Children's Employment Commission of the 13th of June, 1863. For my purpose, it is enough to take from the reports of 1860 and 1863 some depositions of the exploited children themselves. From the children we may form an opinion as to the adults, especially the girls and women, and that in a branch of industry by the side of which cotton spinning appears an agreeable and healthful occupation. William Wood, 9 years old, was 7 years and 10 months when he began to work. He ran moulds, carried ready-moulded articles into the drying-room, afterwards bringing back the empty mould, from the beginning. He came to work every day in the week at 6 a.m. and left off about 9 p.m. I work 9 o'clock at night 6 days in the week. I've done so 7 or 8 weeks. 15 hours of labour for a child 7 years old. J. Murray, 12 years of age, says, I turn jigger and run moulds. I come at 6. Sometimes I come at 4. I worked all night last night till 6 o'clock this morning. I have not been in bed since the night before last. There were 8 or 9 other boys working last night. All but one have come this morning. I get 3 shillings and 6p. I do not get any more for working at night. I worked 2 nights last week. Ferneyho, a boy of 10, I have not always an hour for dinner. I have only half an hour sometimes, on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Dr. Greenhouse states that the average duration of life in the pottery districts of Stoke-on-Trent and Woolstanton is extraordinarily short. Although in the district of Stoke only 36.6% and in Woolstanton only 30.4% of the adult male population above 20 are employed in the potteries, among the men of that age in the first district more than a half, in the second nearly 2/5 of the whole deaths are the result of pulmonary diseases among potters. Dr. Boothroyd, a medical practitioner at Hanley, says, each successive generation of potters is more dwarfed and less robust than the preceding one. In like manner, another doctor, Mr. McBean, since he began to practice among the potters 25 years ago, he had observed a marked degeneration, especially shown in diminution of stature and breadth. These statements are taken from the report of Dr. Greenhow in 1860. From the report of the commissioners in 1863, the following. Dr. J. T. Arledge, senior physician of the North Staffordshire Infirmary, says, the potters as a class, both men and women, represent a degenerated population, both physically and morally. They are, as a rule, stunted in growth, ill-shaped, and frequently ill-formed in the chest. they become prematurely old, and are certainly short-lived. They are phlegmatic and bloodless, and exhibit their debility of constitution by obstinate attacks of dyspepsia, and disorders of the liver and kidneys, and by rheumatism. But of all diseases, they are especially prone to chest disease, to pneumonia, phthisis, bronchitis, and asthma. One form would appear peculiar to them, and is known as Potter's asthma, or Potter's consumption. Scrofula attacking the glands or bones or other parts of the body is a disease of two-thirds or more of the Potters. That the degenerescence of the population of this district is not even greater than it is due to the constant recruiting from the adjacent country, and intermarriages with more healthy races. Mr. Charles Parsons, late house surgeon of the same institution, writes in a letter to Commissioner Long, amongst other things, "I can only speak from personal observation and not from statistical data, but I do not hesitate to assert that my indignation has been aroused again and again at the sight of poor children whose health has been sacrificed to gratify the avarice of either parents or employers." He enumerates the causes of the diseases of the Potters, and sums them up in the phrase, "long hours." The report of the Commission trusts that a manufacture which has assumed so prominent a place in the whole world will not long be subject to the remark that its great success is accompanied with the physical deterioration, widespread bodily suffering, and early death of the workpeople by whose labour and skill such great results have been achieved. And all that holds of the potteries in England is true of those in Scotland. The manufacture of lucifer matches dates from 1833, from the discovery of the method of applying phosphorus to the match itself. Since 1845, this manufacture has rapidly developed in England, and has extended especially amongst the thickly populated parts of London, as well as in Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, Bristol, Norwich, Newcastle, and Glasgow. With it has spread the form of lockjaw, which a Vienna physician in 1845 discovered to be a disease peculiar to lucifer matchmakers. Half the workers are children under 13, and young persons under 18. The manufacture is, on account of its unhealthiness and unpleasantness, in such bad odour that only the most miserable part of the labouring class, half-starved widows and so forth, deliver up their children to it. The ragged, half-starved, untaught children. Of the witnesses that Commissioner White examined, 1863, 270 were under 18, 50 under 10, 10 only 8, and 5 only 6 years old. A range of the working day from 12 to 14 or 15 hours, night labour, irregular meal times, meals for the most part taken in the very workrooms that are pestilent with phosphorus. Dante would have found the worst horrors of his Inferno surpassed in this manufacture. In the manufacture of paper hangings, the coarser sorts are printed by machine, the finer by hand. The most active business months are from the beginning of October to the end of April. During this time the work goes on fast and furious, without intermission, from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., or further into the night. J. Leach deposes, "Last winter, 6 out of 19 girls were away from ill health at one time from overwork. I have to bawl at them to keep them awake." W. Duffy, "I have seen when the children could none of them keep their eyes open for the work. Indeed, none of us could." J. Lightbourne, "Am 13. We worked last winter till 9, evening, and the winter before till 10. I used to cry with sore feet every night last winter." G. Apston, "That boy of mine, when he was 7 years old, I used to carry him on my back to and fro through the snow, and he used to have 16 hours a day. I have often knelt down to feed him as he stood by the machine, for he could not leave it or stop." Smith, the managing partner of a Manchester factory. We, he means his hands who work for us, work on with no stoppage for meals, so that day's work of 10.5 hours is finished by 4:30 p.m., and all after that is overtime. Footnote. This is not to be taken in the same sense as our surplus labour time. These gentlemen consider 10.5 hours of labour as the normal working day, which includes, of course, the normal surplus labour. After this begins overtime, which is paid a little better. It will be seen later that the labour expended during the so-called normal day is paid below its value, so that the overtime is simply a capitalist trick in order to extort more surplus labour, which it would still be, even if the labour power expended during the normal working day were properly paid. End of footnote. Does this Mr. Smith take no meals himself during 10.5 hours? We, this same Smith, seldom leave off working before 6 p.m. He means leave off the consumption of our labour power machines. So that we, iterum Crispinus, are really working overtime the whole year round. For all these, children and adults alike, 152 children and young persons and 140 adults, the average work for the last 18 months has been at the very least 7 days 5 hours, or 78 half-hours a week. For the 6 weeks ending May the 2nd this year, 1862, the average was higher, 8 days, or 84 hours a week. Still, this same Mr. Smith, who is so extremely devoted to the pluralis majestatis, the royal we, that is, speaking on behalf of his subjects, adds with a smile, "Machine work is not great." So the employers in the block printing say, "Hand labour is more healthy than machine work." On the whole, manufacturers declare with indignation against the proposal to stop the machines, at least during meal times. A clause, says Mr. Otley, manager of a wallpaper factory in the borough, which allowed work between, say, 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. would suit us very well, but the factory hours, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., are not suitable. Our machine is always stopped for dinner. What generosity! There is no waste of paper and colour to speak of. But, he adds sympathetically, I can understand the loss of time not being liked. The report of the Commission opines with naivety that the fear of some leading firms of losing time, that is, the time for appropriating the labour of others and thence losing profit, is not a sufficient reason for allowing children under 13 and young persons under 18 working 12 to 16 hours per day to lose their dinner, nor for giving it to them as coal and water are supplied to the steam engine, soap to wool, oil to the wheel, as merely auxiliary material to the instruments of labour during the process of production itself. No branch of industry in England, we do not take into account the making of bread by machinery recently introduced, has preserved up to the present day a method of production so archaic, so, as we see from the poets of the Roman Empire, pre-Christian, as baking. But capital, as was said earlier, is at first indifferent as to the technical character of the labour process. It begins by taking it just as it finds it. The incredible adulteration of bread, especially in London, was first revealed by the House of Commons Committee on the Adulteration of Articles of Food, 1855-56, and Dr. Hassell's work, Adulterations Detected. Footnote. Alum, finely powdered or mixed with salt, is a normal article of commerce bearing the significant name of baker's stuff. End of footnote. The consequence of these revelations was the Act of August the 6th, 1860, for preventing the adulteration of articles of food and drink, an inoperative law, as it naturally shows the tenderest consideration for every free trader who determines by the buying or selling of adulterated commodities to turn an honest penny. Footnote. Soot is a well-known and very energetic form of carbon, and forms a manure that capitalistic chimney sweeps sell to English farmers. Now, in 1862, the British juryman had in a lawsuit to decide whether soot, with which, unknown to the buyer, 90% of dust and sand are mixed, is genuine soot in the commercial sense, or adulterated soot in the legal sense. The Amis du Commerce, Friends of Commerce, decided it to be genuine commercial soot, and non-suited the plaintiff farmer, who had in addition to pay the costs of the suit. End of footnote. The committee itself formulated, more or less naively, its conviction that free trade meant essentially trade with adulterated, or, as the English ingeniously put it, sophisticated, goods. In fact, this kind of sophistry knows better than Protagoras how to make white black and black white, and better than the Eleatics how to demonstrate ad oculos before your own eyes that everything is only appearance. Footnote. The French chemist Chevalier, in his treatise on the sophistications of commodities, enumerates for many of the 600 or more articles which he passes in review 10, 20, 30 different methods of adulteration. He adds that he does not know all the methods, and does not mention all that he knows. He gives 6 kinds of adulteration of sugar, 9 of olive oil, 10 of butter, 12 of salt, 19 of milk, 20 of bread, 23 of brandy, 24 of meal, 28 of chocolate, 30 of wine, 32 of coffee, etc. Even God Almighty does not escape this fate. See Rua de Car, On the Falsifications of the Materials of the Sacrament, De la Falsification des Substances Sacramentelles, Paris, 1856, end of footnote. At all events, the committee had directed the attention of the public to its daily bread, and therefore to the baking trade. At the same time, in public meetings and in petitions to Parliament, rose the cry of the London journeymen bakers, against their overwork, etc. The cry was so urgent that Mr. H.S. Tremenhere, also a member of the Commission of 1863, several times mentioned, was appointed Royal Commissioner of Inquiry. His report, together with the evidence given, roused not the heart of the public, but its stomach. Englishmen, always well up in the Bible, knew well enough that man, unless by elective grace a capitalist or landlord or sinecurist, is commanded to eat his bread in the sweat of his brow. But they did not know that he had to eat daily in his bread a certain quantity of human perspiration mixed with the discharge of abscesses, cobwebs, dead black beetles, and putrid German yeast, without counting alum, sand, and other agreeable mineral ingredients. Without any regard to His Holiness free trade, the free baking trade was therefore placed under the supervision of the state inspectors, close of the parliamentary session of 1863, and by the same Act of Parliament, work from 9 in the evening to 5 in the morning was forbidden for journeymen bakers under 18. The last clause speaks volumes as to the overwork in this old-fashioned, homely line of business. The work of a London journeyman baker begins, as a rule, at about 11 at night. At that hour he makes the dough, a laborious process which lasts from half an hour to three-quarters of an hour, according to the size of the batch or the labour bestowed upon it. He then lies down upon the kneading board, which is also the covering of the trough in which the dough is made, and with a sack under him and another rolled up as a pillow, he sleeps for about a couple of hours. He is then engaged in a rapid and continuous labour for about 5 hours, throwing out the dough, scaling it off, moulding it, putting it into the oven, preparing and baking rolls and fancy bread, taking the batch bread out of the oven and up into the shop, etc., etc. The temperature of a bakehouse ranges from about 75 to upwards of 90 degrees, and in the smaller bakehouses approximates usually to the higher rather than to the lower degree of heat. When the business of making the bread, rolls, etc. is over, that of its distribution begins, and a considerable proportion of the journeymen in the trade, after working hard in the manner described during the night, are upon their legs for many hours during the day, carrying baskets or wheeling handcarts, and sometimes again in the bakehouse, leaving off work at various hours between 1 and 6 p.m. according to the season of the year, or the amount and nature of their master's business, while others are again engaged in the bakehouse in bringing out more batches until late in the afternoon. During what is called the London season, the operatives belonging to the full-priced bakers at the west end of town generally begin work at 11 p.m. and are engaged in making the bread, with one or two short, sometimes very short, intervals of rest, up to 8 o'clock the next morning. They are then engaged all day long, up to 4, 5, 6, and as late as 7 o'clock in the evening, carrying out bread, or sometimes in the afternoon in the bakehouse again, assisting in the biscuit baking. They may have, after they have done their work, sometimes 5 or 6, sometimes only 4 or 5, hours sleep before they begin again. On Fridays, they always begin sooner, some about 10 o'clock, and continue in some cases at work, either in making or delivering the bread, up to 8 p.m. on Saturday night, but more generally up to 4 or 5 o'clock Sunday morning. On Sundays the men must attend twice or three times during the day for an hour or two to make preparations for the next day's bread. The men employed by the underselling masters, who sell their bread under the full price, and who, as already pointed out, comprise three-fourths of the London bakers, have not only to work on the average longer hours, but their work is almost entirely confined to the bakehouse. The underselling masters generally sell their bread in the shop. If they send it out, which is not common, except as supplying chandlers' shops, they usually employ other hands for that purpose. It is not their practice to deliver bread from house to house. Towards the end of the week, the men begin on Thursday night at 10 o'clock and continue on, with only slight intermission, until late on Saturday evening. Even the bourgeois intellect understands the position of the underselling masters. Quote, "The unpaid labour of the men was made the source whereby the competition was carried on." Unquote. Footnote. George Read, The History of Baking, London, 1848, end of footnote. And the full-priced baker denounces his underselling competitors to the Commission of Inquiry as thieves of foreign labour and adulterers. Quote, "They only exist now by first defrauding the public and next getting 18 hours' work out of their men for 12 hours' wages." Unquote. Footnote. Report, first, etc., Evidence of the Full-Priced Baker Cheeseman. End of footnote. The adulteration of bread, and the formation of a class of bakers that sells the bread below the full price, date from the beginning of the 18th century, from the time when the corporate character of the trade was lost, and the capitalist in the form of the miller or flour factor rises behind the nominal master baker. Footnote. George Read. At the end of the 17th and the beginning of the 18th centuries, the factors, agents, that crowded into every possible trade were still denounced as public nuisances. Thus, the grand jury at the quarter session of the Justices of the Peace for the County of Somerset addressed a presentment to the lower house, which, among other things, states that these factors of Blackwell Hall are a public nuisance and prejudice to the clothing trade, and ought to be put down as a nuisance. The Case of Our English Wool, etc., London, 1685. End of footnote. Thus was laid the foundation of capitalistic production in this trade, of the unlimited extension of the working day and of night labour, although the latter only since 1824 gained a serious footing, even in London. After what has just been said, it will be understood that the report of the Commission classes journeymen bakers among the short-lived labourers, who, having by good luck escaped the normal decimation of the children of the working class, rarely reach the age of 42. Nevertheless, the baking trade is always overwhelmed with applicants. The sources of the supply of these labour powers to London are Scotland, the western agricultural districts of England, and Germany. In the years 1858-60, the journeymen bakers in Ireland organised at their own expense great meetings to agitate against night and Sunday work. The public, for example, at the Dublin meeting in May 1860, took their part with Irish warmth. As a result of this movement, day labour alone was successfully established in Wexford, Kilkenny, Clonmel, Waterford, etc. Quote, "In Limerick, where the grievances of the journeymen are demonstrated to be excessive, the movement has been defeated by the opposition of the master bakers, the miller bakers being the greatest opponents. The example of Limerick led to a retrogression in Ennis and Tipperary. In Cork, where the strongest possible demonstration of feeling took place, the masters, by exercising their power of turning the men out of employment, have defeated the movement. In Dublin, the master bakers have offered the most determined opposition to the movement, and by discountenancing as much as possible the journeymen promoting it, have succeeded in leading the men into acquiescence in Sunday work and night work, contrary to the convictions of the men." Unquote. Footnote. Report of Committee on the Baking Trade in Ireland for 1861. End of footnote. The committee of the English government, which government in Ireland is armed to the teeth and generally knows how to show it, remonstrates in mild, though funereal tones, with the implacable master bakers of Dublin, Limerick, Cork, etc. "The committee believes that the hours of labour are limited by natural laws, which cannot be violated with impunity. That for master bakers to induce their workmen, by the fear of losing employment, to violate their religious convictions and their better feelings, to disobey the laws of the land, and to disregard public opinion," this all refers to Sunday labour, "is calculated to provoke ill feeling between workmen and masters, and affords an example dangerous to religion, morality, and social order. The committee believe that any constant work, beyond 12 hours a day, encroaches on the domestic and private life of the working man, and so leads to disastrous moral results, interfering with each man's home and the discharge of his family duties as a son, a brother, a husband, a father. That work beyond 12 hours has a tendency to undermine the health of the working man, and so leads to premature old age and death, to the great injury of families of working men, thus deprived of the care and support of the head of the family when most required." So far, we have dealt with Ireland. On the other side of the Channel, in Scotland, the agricultural labourer, the ploughman, protests against his 13 to 14 hours work in the most inclement climate, with 4 hours additional work on Sunday. In this land of Sabbatarians. Footnote. Public meeting of agricultural labourers at Lasswade, near Edinburgh, January 5, 1866. See Workman's Advocate, January 13, 1866. The formation, since the close of 1865, of a trades union among the agricultural labourers, at first in Scotland, is a historic event. In one of the most oppressed agricultural districts of England, Buckinghamshire, the labourers in March 1867 made a great strike for the raising of their weekly wage from 9 to 10 shillings to 12 shillings. It will be seen from the preceding passage that the movement of the English agricultural proletariat, entirely crushed since the suppression of its violent manifestations after 1830, and especially since the introduction of the new poor laws, begins again in the 60s, until it becomes finally epoch-making in 1872. I return to this in the second volume, as well as to the blue books that have appeared since 1867 on the position of the English land labourers. Addendum to the third edition. End of footnote. Whilst, at the same time, three railwaymen are standing before a London coroner's jury, a guard, an engine driver, a signalman. A tremendous railway accident has hurried hundreds of passengers into another world. The negligence of the employee is the cause of the misfortune. They declare with one voice before the jury that 10 or 12 years before, their labour only lasted 8 hours a day. During the last 5 or 6 years, it had been screwed up to 14, 18, and 20 hours, and under especially severe pressure of holiday makers, at times of excursion trains, it often lasted for 40 or 50 hours without a break. They were ordinary men, not cyclops. At a certain point, their labour power failed. Torpor seized them. Their brain ceased to think, their eyes to see. The thoroughly respectable British jurymen answered by a verdict that sent them to the next assizes on a charge of manslaughter, and, in a gentle rider to their verdict, expressed the pious hope that the capitalistic magnates of the railways would, in future, be more extravagant in the purchase of a sufficient quantity of labour power, and more abstemious, more self-denying, more thrifty in the draining of paid labour power. Footnote. Reynolds Newspaper, January 1866. Every week this same paper has, under the sensational headings, Fearful and Fatal Accidents, Appalling Tragedies, etc., a whole list of fresh railway catastrophes. On these, an employee on the North Staffordshire line comments, "Everyone knows the consequences that may occur if the driver and fireman of a locomotive engine are not continually on the lookout. How can that be expected from a man who has been at work for 29 or 30 hours, exposed to the weather and without rest?" The following is an example which is of very frequent occurrence. One fireman commenced work on the Monday morning at a very early hour. When he had finished what is called a day's work, he had been on duty 14 hours 50 minutes. Before he had time to get his tea, he was again called on for duty. The next time he finished, he had been on duty 14 hours 25 minutes, making a total of 29 hours 15 minutes without intermission. The rest of the week's work was made up as follows. Wednesday, 15 hours. Thursday, 15 hours 35 minutes. Friday, 14 and a half hours. Saturday, 14 hours 10 minutes, making a total for the week of 88 hours 30 minutes. Now, sir, fancy his astonishment on being paid 6 and a quarter days for the whole. Thinking it was a mistake, he applied to the timekeeper and inquired what they considered a day's work, and was told 13 hours for a goods man, that is, 78 hours. He then asked for what he had made over and above the 78 hours per week, but was refused. However, he was at last told they would give him another quarter, that is, 10 pence. 1866. End of footnote. From the motley crowd of labourers of all callings, ages, sexes, that press on us more busily than the souls of the slain on Ulysses, on whom, without referring to the blue books under their arms, we see at a glance the mark of overwork, let us take two more figures, whose striking contrast proves that before capital all men are alike. A milliner and a blacksmith. In the last week of June, 1863, all the London daily papers published a paragraph with the sensational heading, Death from Simple Overwork. It dealt with the death of the milliner Mary Ann Walkley, 20 years of age, employed in a highly respectable dressmaking establishment, exploited by a lady with the pleasant name of Elise. The old, often-told story was once more recounted. This girl worked, on an average, 16.5 hours, during the season often 30 hours, without a break, whilst her failing labour power was revived by occasional supplies of sherry, port or coffee. It was just now the height of the season. It was necessary to conjure up, in the twinkling of an eye, the gorgeous dresses for the noble ladies bidden to the ball in honour of the newly imported Princess of Wales. Marianne Walkley had worked without intermission for 26.5 hours, with 60 other girls, 30 in one room, that only afforded 1/3 of the cubic feet of air required for them. At night, they slept in pairs, in one of the stifling holes into which the bedroom was divided by partitions of board. Footnote. Dr. Leithby, consulting physician of the Board of Health, declared, "The minimum of air for each adult ought to be in a sleeping room 300, and in a dwelling room 500 cubic feet." Dr. Richardson, senior physician to one of the London hospitals, "With needlewomen of all kinds, including milliners, dressmakers, and ordinary seamstresses, there are three miseries: overwork, deficient air, and either deficient food or deficient digestion. Needlework, in the main, is infinitely better adapted to women than to men, but the mischiefs of the trade, in the metropolis especially, are that it is monopolized by some 26 capitalists, who, under the advantages that spring from capital, can bring in capital to force economy out of labor. This power tells throughout the whole class. If a dressmaker can get a little circle of customers, such is the competition that in her home she must work to the death to hold together, and this same overwork she must of necessity inflict on any who may assist her. If she fail, or do not try independently, she must join an establishment where her labour is not less, but where her money is safe. Placed thus, she becomes a mere slave, tossed about with the variations of society. Now at home, in one room, starving or near to it, then engaged 15, 16, aye, even 18 hours out of the 24, in an air that is scarcely tolerable, and on food which, even if it be good, cannot be digested in the absence of pure air. On these victims, consumption, which is purely a disease of bad air, feeds. Dr. Richardson, Work and Overwork, in Social Science Review, 1863. End of footnote. And this was one of the best millinery establishments in London. Mary Ann Walkley fell ill on the Friday, died on Sunday, without, to the astonishment of Madame Elise, having previously completed the work in hand. The doctor, Mr. Keyes, called too late to the deathbed, duly bore witness before the coroner's jury that Mary Ann Walkley had died from long hours of work in an overcrowded workroom and a too small and badly ventilated bedroom. In order to give the doctor a lesson in good manners, the coroner's jury thereupon brought in a verdict that the deceased had died of apoplexy, but there was reason to fear that her death had been accelerated by overwork in an overcrowded workroom, etc. "Our white slaves," cried the Morning Star, the organ of the free traders Cobden and Bright, "our white slaves, who are toiled into the grave, for the most part silently pine and die." Footnote. Morning Star, 23rd of June, 1863. The Times made use of the circumstance to defend the American slave owners against Bright, etc. "Very many of us think," says a leader of July the 2nd, 1863, "that while we work our own young women to death using the scourge of starvation, instead of the crack of the whip, as the instrument of compulsion, we have scarcely a right to hound on fire and slaughter against families who were born slave owners, and who, at least, feed their slaves well and work them lightly. In the same manner, the Standard, a Tory organ, fell foul of the Reverend Newman Hall. He excommunicated the slave owners, but prays with the fine folk who, without remorse, make the omnibus drivers and conductors of London, etc., work 16 hours a day for the wages of a dog. Finally spake the oracle Thomas Carlyle, of whom I wrote in 1850, "In the cult of genius, the cult remains." Paraphrasing Schiller in a short parable, he reduces the one great event of contemporary history, the American Civil War, to this level, that the Peter of the North wants to break the head of the Paul of the South with all his might, because the Peter of the North hires his labour by day, and the Paul of the South hires his by the life. Macmillan's Magazine, Ilias Americana in Nutque, August 1863. Thus the bubble of Tory sympathy for the urban workers, by no means for the rural, has burst at last. The sum of all is slavery. End of footnote. Quote, "It is not in dressmakers' rooms that working to death is the order of the day, but in 1,000 other places. In every place, I had almost said, where a thriving business has to be done. We will take the blacksmith as a type. If the poets were true, there is no man so hearty, so merry as the blacksmith. He rises early and strikes his sparks before the sun. He eats and drinks and sleeps as no other man. Working in moderation, he is, in fact, in one of the best of human positions, physically speaking. But we follow him into the city or town, and we see the stress of work on that strong man, and what then is his position in the death rate of his country? In Marylebone, blacksmiths die at the rate of 31 per 1,000 per annum, or 11 above the mean of the male adults of the country in its entirety. The occupation, instinctive almost as a portion of human art, unobjectionable as a branch of human industry, is made by mere excess of work, the destroyer of man. He can strike so many blows per day, walk so many steps, breathe so many breaths, produce so much work, and live an average, say, of 50 years. He is made to strike so many more blows, to walk so many more steps, to breathe so many more breaths per day, and to increase altogether a fourth of his life. He meets the effort. The result is that producing for a limited time a fourth more work, he dies at 37 for 50. Unquote. Footnote, Dr. Richardson. End of footnote. Section 4. Day and Night Work. The Relay System. Constant capital, the means of production, considered from the standpoint of the creation of surplus value, only exists to absorb labour, and with every drop of labour, a proportional quantity of surplus labour. While they fail to do this, their mere existence causes a relative loss to the capitalist, for they represent, during the time they lie fallow, a useless advance of capital. And this loss becomes positive and absolute as soon as the intermission of their employment necessitates additional outlay at the recommencement of work. The prolongation of the working day beyond the limits of the natural day into the night only acts as a palliative. It quenches only in a slight degree the vampire thirst for the living blood of labour. To appropriate labour during all the 24 hours of the day is, therefore, the inherent tendency of capitalist production. But as it is physically impossible to exploit the same individual labour power constantly during the night as well as the day, to overcome this physical hindrance, an alternation becomes necessary between the workpeople whose powers are exhausted by day and those who are used up by night. This alternation may be effected in various ways. For example, It may be so arranged that part of the workers are 1 week employed on day work, the next week on night work. It is well known that this relay system, this alternation of two sets of workers, held full sway in the full-blooded youth time of the English cotton manufacture, and that at the present time it still flourishes, among others, in the cotton spinning of the Moscow district. This 24 hours process of production exists today as a system in many of the branches of industry of Great Britain that are still free. In the blast furnaces, forges, plate rolling mills, and other metallurgical establishments in England, Wales, and Scotland. The working time here includes, besides the 24 hours of the 6 working days, a great part also of the 24 hours of Sunday. The workers consist of men and women, adults and children of both sexes. The ages of the children and young persons run through all intermediate grades, from 8, in some cases from 6, to 18. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1864. End of footnote. In some branches of industry, the girls and women work through the night together with the males. Footnote. Both in Staffordshire and in South Wales, young girls and women are employed on the pit banks and on the coke heaps not only by day, but also by night. This practice has been often noticed in reports presented to Parliament as being attended with great and notorious evils. These females employed with the men, hardly distinguished from them in their dress and begrimed with dirt and smoke, are exposed to the deterioration of character arising from the loss of self-respect, which can hardly fail to follow from their unfeminine occupation. 1865. It is the same in glassworks. End of footnote. Footnote. A steel manufacturer who employs children in night labour remarked, "It seems but natural that boys who work at night cannot sleep and get proper rest by day, but will be running about." On the importance of sunlight for the maintenance and growth of the body, a physician writes, "Light also acts upon the tissues of the body directly in hardening them and supporting their elasticity. The muscles of animals, when they are deprived of a proper amount of light, become soft and inelastic. The nervous power loses its tone from defective stimulation, and the elaboration of all growth seems to be perverted." In the case of children, constant access to plenty of light during the day and to the direct rays of the sun for a part of it is most essential to health. Light assists in the elaboration of good plastic blood and hardens the fibre after it has been laid down. It also acts as a stimulus upon the organs of sight, and by this means brings about more activity in the various cerebral functions. Dr. W. Strange, senior physician of the Worcester General Hospital, from whose work on health, 1864, this passage is taken, writes in a letter to Mr. White, one of the commissioners, "I have had opportunities formerly, when in Lancashire, of observing the effects of night work upon children, and I have no hesitation in saying, contrary to what some employers were fond of asserting, those children who were subjected to it soon suffered in their health. That such a question should furnish the material of serious controversy shows plainly how capitalist production acts on the brain functions of capitalists and their retainers." End of footnote. Placing on one side the generally injurious influence of night labour, the duration of the process of production, unbroken during the 24 hours, offers very welcome opportunities of exceeding the limits of the normal working day. For example, in the branches of industry already mentioned, which are of an exceedingly fatiguing nature. The official working day means for each worker usually 12 hours by night or day, but the overwork beyond this amount is in many cases, to use the words of the English official report, truly fearful. It is impossible, the report continues, for any mind to realize the amount of work described in the following passages as being performed by boys of from 9 to 12 years of age without coming irresistibly to the conclusion that such abuses of the power of parents and of employers can no longer be allowed to exist. The practice of boys working at all by day and night turns, either in the usual course of things or at pressing times, seems inevitably to open the door to their not unfrequently working unduly long hours. These hours are, indeed, in some cases, not only cruelly but even incredibly long for children. Amongst a number of boys it will, of course, not unfrequently happen that one or more are from some cause absent. When this happens, their place is made up by one or more boys who work in the other turn. That this is a well-understood system is plain from the answer of the manager of some large rolling mills who, when I asked him how the place of boys absent from their turn was made up, "I dare say, sir, you know that as well as I do," and admitted the fact. At a rolling mill where the proper hours were from 6 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., a boy worked about four nights every week till 8:30 p.m. at least, and this for 6 months. Another, at 9 years old, sometimes made 3 12-hour shifts running, and when 10, has made 2 days and 2 nights running. A third, now 10, worked from 6 a.m. till 12 p.m. 3 nights, and till 9 p.m. the other nights. Another, now 13, worked from 6 p.m. till 12 noon the next day for a week together, and sometimes for 3 shifts together. For example, from Monday morning till Tuesday night. Another, now 12, has worked in an iron foundry at Staveley from 6 a.m. till 12 p.m. for a fortnight on end. Could not do it any more. George Allensworth, age 9. Came here as a cellar boy last Friday. Next morning we had to begin at 3, so I stopped here all night. Live 5 miles off. Slept on the floor of the furnace overhead, with an apron under me and a bit of a jacket over me. The 2 other days I have been here at 6 a.m. Aye, it is hot in here. Before I came here I was nearly a year at the same work, at some works in the country. Began there too at 3 on Saturday morning, always did, but it was very near home, and could sleep at home. Other days I began at 6 in the morning, and gin over at 6 or 7 in the evening, etc. Footnote. The degree of culture of these labour powers must naturally be such as appears in the following dialogues with one of the commissioners. Jeremiah Haynes, age 12. 4 times 4 is 8, 4 fours are 16. A king is him that has all the money and gold. We have a king, told it is a queen. They call her the Princess Alexandra, told that she married the queen's son. The queen's son is the Princess Alexandra. A princess is a man. William Turner, age 12. Don't live in England. Think it's a country, but didn't know before. John Morris, age 14. Have heard say that God made the world, and that all the people was drowned but one. Heard say that one was a little bird. William Smith, age 15. God made man, man made woman. Edward Taylor, age 15. Do not know of London. Henry Matthewman, age 17. Had been to chapel, but missed a good many times lately. One name that they preached about was Jesus Christ, but I cannot say any others, and I cannot tell anything about him. He was not killed, but died like other people. He was not the same as other people in some ways, because he was religious in some ways, and others isn't. The devil is a good person. I don't know where he lives. Christ was a wicked man. This girl spelt God as dog, and did not know the name of the queen. Children's Employment Commission, 1866. The same system obtains in the glass and paper works as in the metallurgical, already cited. In the paper factories, where the paper is made by machinery, Night work is the rule for all processes except rag sorting. In some cases, night work, by relays, is carried on incessantly through the whole week, usually from Sunday night until midnight of the following Saturday. Those who are on day work work 5 days of 12 and 1 day of 18 hours. Those on night work, 5 nights of 12 and 1 of 6 hours in each week. In other cases, each set works 24 hours consecutively on alternate days, one set working 6 hours on Monday and 18 on Saturday to make up the 24 hours. In other cases, an intermediate system prevails, by which all employed on the papermaking machinery work 15 or 16 hours every day in the week. This system, says Commissioner Lord, seems to combine all the evils of both the 12 hours and the 24 hours relays. Children under 13, young persons under 18, and women work under this night system. Sometimes, under the 12 hours system, they are obliged, on account of the non-appearance of those that ought to relieve them, to work a double turn of 24 hours. The evidence proves that boys and girls very often work overtime, which, not unfrequently, extends to 24 or even 36 hours of uninterrupted toil. In the continuous and unvarying process of glazing are found girls of 12 who work the whole month 14 hours a day, without any regular relief or cessation beyond 2 or at most 3 breaks of half an hour each for meals. In some mills where regular night work has been entirely given up, overwork goes on to a terrible extent, and that often in the dirtiest and in the hottest and in the most monotonous of the various processes. Children's Employment Commission. End of footnote. Let us now hear how capital itself regards this 24 hours system. The extreme forms of the system, its abuse in the cruel and incredible extension of the working day, are naturally passed over in silence. Capital only speaks of the system in its normal form. Messrs. Naylor and Vickers, steel manufacturers, who employ between 600 and 700 persons, among whom only 10% are under 18, and of those only 20 boys under 18 work in night sets, thus express themselves. The boys do not suffer from the heat. The temperature is probably from 86 degrees to 90 degrees. At the forges and in the rolling mills, the hands work night and day in relays, but all the other parts of the work are day work, that is, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. In the forge, the hours are from 12 to 12. Some of the hands always work in the night without any alternation of day and night work. We do not find any difference in the health of those who work regularly by night and those who work by day, and probably people can sleep better if they have the same period of rest than if it is changed. About 20 of the boys under age of 18 work in the night sets. We could not well do without lads under 18 working by night. The objection would be the increase in the cost of production. Skilled hands and the heads in every department are difficult to get, but of lads we could get any number. But from the small proportion of boys that we employ, the subject, that is, of restrictions on night work, is of little importance or interest to us. Mr. J. Ellis, one of the firm of Messrs. John Brown and Co., Steel and Iron Works, employing about 3,000 men and boys, part of whose operations, namely iron and heavier steel work, goes on night and day by relays, states that in the heavier steel work, one or two boys are employed to a score or two of men. Their concern employs upwards of 500 boys under 18, of whom about one-third, or 170, are under the age of 13. With reference to the proposed alteration of the law, Mr. Ellis says, "I do not think it would be very objectionable to require that no person under the age of 18 should work more than 12 hours in the 24, but we do not think that any line could be drawn over the age of 12 at which boys could be dispensed with for night work. but we would sooner be prevented from employing boys under the age of 13, or even so high as 14 at all, than not be allowed to employ boys that we do have at night. Those boys who work in the day sets must take their turn in the night sets also, because the men could not work in the night sets only, it would ruin their health. We think, however, that night work in alternate weeks is no harm. Messrs. Naylor and Vickers, on the other hand, in conformity with the interest of their business, considered that periodically changed night labour might possibly do more harm than continual night labour. We find the men who do it, as well as the others who do other work only by day. Our objections to not allowing boys under 18 to work at night would be on account of the increase of expense, but this is the only reason. What cynical naivete! We think that the increase would be more than the trade, with due regard to its being successfully carried out, could fairly bear. What mealy-mouthed phraseology! Labour is scarce here, and might fall short if there were such a regulation. That is, Ellis Brown and Co. might fall into the fatal perplexity of being obliged to pay labour power its full value. The Cyclops Steel and Iron Works of Messrs. Camel and Co. are concocted on the same large scale as those of the above-mentioned John Brown and Co. The managing director had handed in his evidence to the government commissioner, Mr. White, in writing. Later he found it convenient to suppress the manuscript when it had been returned to him for revision. Mr. White, however, has a good memory. He remembered quite clearly that for the Messrs. Cyclops, the forbidding of the night labour of children and young persons would be impossible. It would be tantamount to stopping their works. And yet their business employs little more than 6% of boys under 18 and less than 1% under 13. On the same subject, Mr. E.F. Sanderson, of the firm of Sanderson, Bross and Co., steel rolling mills and forges, Attercliffe, says, "Great difficulty would be caused by preventing boys under 18 from working at night. The chief would be the increase of cost from employing men instead of boys. I cannot say what this would be, but probably it would not be enough to enable the manufacturers to raise the price of steel, and consequently it would fall on them, as of course the men, what queer-headed folk, would refuse to pay it." Mr. Sanderson does not know how much he pays the children, but perhaps the younger boys get from 4 shillings to 5 shillings a week. The boys' work is of a kind for which the strength of boys is generally, of course, not always, quite sufficient, and consequently there would be no gain in the greater strength of the men to counterbalance the loss, or it would be only in the few cases in which the metal is heavy. The men would not like so well not to have boys under them, as men would be less obedient. Besides, boys must begin young to learn the trade. Leaving day work alone open to boys would not answer this purpose. And why not? Why could not boys learn their handicraft in the daytime? Your reason? Owing to the men working days and nights in alternate weeks, the men would be separated half the time from their boys and would lose half the profit which they make from them. The training which they give to an apprentice is considered as part of the return for the boy's labour, and thus enables the man to get it at a cheaper rate. Each man would want half of this profit. In other words, Messrs. Sanderson would have to pay part of the wages of the adult men out of their own pockets, instead of by the night work of the boys. Messrs. Sanderson's profit would thus fall to some extent, and this is the good Sandersonian reason why boys cannot learn their handicraft in the day. Footnote. In our reflecting and reasoning age, a man is not worth much who cannot give a good reason for everything, no matter how bad or crazy. Everything in the world that has been done wrong has been done wrong for the very best of reasons. End of footnote. In addition to this, it would throw night labour on those who worked instead of the boys, which they would not be able to stand. The difficulties, in fact, would be so great that they would very likely lead to the giving up of night work altogether. And, as far as the work itself is concerned, says E.F. Sanderson, this would suit as well, but... But Messrs. Sanderson have something else to make besides steel. Steel-making is simply a pretext for surplus-value-making. The smelting furnaces, rolling mills, etc., the buildings, machinery, iron, coal, etc., have something more to do than transform themselves into steel. They are there to absorb surplus labour, and naturally absorb more in 24 hours than in 12. In fact, they give, by grace of God and law, the Sandersons a check on the working time of a certain number of hands for all the 24 hours of the day, and they lose their character as capital, are therefore a pure loss for the Sandersons as soon as their function of absorbing labour is interrupted. But then there would be the loss from so much expensive machinery lying idle half the time, and to get through the amount of work which we are able to do on the present system, we should have to double our premises and plant, which would double the outlay. But why should these Sandersons pretend to a privilege not enjoyed by the other capitalists who only work during the day, and whose buildings, machinery, raw material, therefore, lie idle during the night? E.F. Sanderson answers in the name of all the Sandersons. It is true that there is this loss from machinery lying idle in those manufactories in which work only goes on by day, but the use of furnaces would involve a further loss in our case. If they were kept up, there would be a waste of fuel, instead of, as now, a waste of the living substance of the workers, and if they were not, there would be loss of time in laying the fires and getting the heat up, while the loss of sleeping time, even to children of 8, is a gain of working time for the Sanderson tribe, and the furnaces themselves would suffer from changes of temperature, whilst those same furnaces suffer nothing from the day and night change of labour. Footnote. To similar tender scruples of the glass manufacturers, that regular meal times for the children are impossible because, as a consequence of a certain quantity of heat radiated by the furnaces, would be a pure loss or wasted, Commissioner White makes answer. His answer is unlike that of Ure, Senior, etc., and their puny German plagiarist a la Rocher, who are touched by the abstinence, self-denial, saving of the capitalists in the expenditure of their gold, and by their Timur-Tamilinish prodigality of human life. A certain amount of heat, beyond what is usual at present, might also be going to waste if mealtimes were secured in these cases, but it seems likely not equal in money value to the waste of animal power now going on in glass houses throughout the kingdom, from growing boys not having enough quiet time to eat their meals at ease, with a little rest afterwards for digestion. And this in the year of progress 1865. Without considering the expenditure of strength in lifting and carrying, such a child in the sheds where bottle and flint glass are made walks during the performance of his work 15 to 20 miles in every 6 hours. And the work often lasts 14 or 15 hours. In many of these glass works, as in the Moscow spinning mills, the system of 6 hours relays is in force. During the working part of the week, 6 hours is the utmost unbroken period ever attained at any one time for rest, and out of this has to come the time spent in coming and going to and from work, washing, dressing, and meals, leaving a very short period indeed for rest, and none for fresh air and play, unless at the expense of the sleep necessary for young boys, especially at such hot and fatiguing work. Even the short sleep is obviously liable to be broken by a boy having to wake himself if it is night, or by the noise if it is day. Mr. White gives cases where a boy worked 36 consecutive hours, others where boys of 12 drudged on until 2 in the morning, and then slept in the works till 5 a.m. 3 hours. only to resume their work. The amount of work, say Tremenheer and Tufnell, who drafted the general report, done by boys, youths, girls, and women in the course of their daily or nightly spell of labour, is certainly extraordinary. Meanwhile, late by night, self-denying Mr. Glass Capital, primed with port wine, reels out of his club, homeward droning out idiotically, "Britons never, never shall be slaves." End of footnote. Section 5. The Struggle for a Normal Working Day. Compulsory Laws for the Extension of the Working Day. From the middle of the 14th to the end of the 17th century. What is a working day? What is the length of time during which capital may consume the labour power whose daily value it buys? How far may the working day be extended beyond the working time necessary for the reproduction of labour power itself? It has been seen that to these questions, capital replies, "The working day contains the full 24 hours, with the deduction of the few hours of repose, without which labour power absolutely refuses its service again. Hence it is self-evident that the labourer is nothing else, his whole life through, than labour power, that therefore all his disposable time is by nature and law labour time, to be devoted to the self-expansion of capital. Time for education, for intellectual development, for the fulfilling of social functions and for social intercourse, for the free play of his bodily and mental activity, even the rest time of Sunday, and that in a country of Sabbatarians. Moonshine. Footnote. In England, even now, occasionally in rural districts, a labourer is condemned to imprisonment for desecrating the Sabbath by working in his front garden. The same labourer is punished for breach of contract if he remains away from his metal, paper or glassworks on a Sunday, even if it be from a religious whim. The Orthodox Parliament will hear nothing of Sabbath-breaking if it occurs in the process of expanding capital. A memorial, August 1863, in which the London day labourers in fish and poultry shops ask for the abolition of Sunday labour, states that their work lasts for the first 6 days of the week on an average 15 hours a day, and on Sunday 8 to 10 hours. From this same memorial we learn also that the delicate gourmands among the aristocratic hypocrites of Exeter Hall especially encourage this Sunday labour. These holy ones, so zealous in cute curanda in attending to their bodily pleasures, show their Christianity by the humility with which they bear the overwork, the privations, and the hunger of others. Obsequium ventris istis, perniciosius est. Gluttony is more ruinous to their stomachs. Paraphrase of Horace, end of footnote. But in its blind, unrestrainable passion, its werewolf hunger for surplus labour, capital oversteps not only the moral, but even the mere physical maximum bounds of the working day. It usurps the time for growth, development, and healthy maintenance of the body. It steals the time required for the consumption of fresh air and sunlight. It higgles over a mealtime, incorporating it where possible with the process of production itself, so that food is given to the labourer as to a mere means of production, as coal is supplied to the boiler, grease and oil to the machinery. It reduces the sound sleep needed for the restoration, reparation, refreshment of the bodily powers to just so many hours of torpor as the revival of an organism absolutely exhausted renders essential. It is not the normal maintenance of the labour power which is to determine the limits of the working day. It is the greatest possible daily expenditure of labour power, no matter how diseased, compulsory, and painful it may be, which is to determine the limits of the labourer's period of repose. Capital cares nothing for the length of life of labour power. All that concerns it is simply and solely the maximum of labour power that can be rendered fluent in a working day. It attains this end by shortening the extent of the labourer's life, as a greedy farmer snatches increased produce from the soil by robbing it of its fertility. The capitalistic mode of production, essentially the production of surplus value, the absorption of surplus labour, produces thus, with the extension of the working day, not only the deterioration of human labour power by robbing it of its normal, moral and physical conditions of development and function, it produces also the premature exhaustion and death of this labour power itself. Footnote. We have given in our previous reports the statements of several experienced manufacturers to the